and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of Attorney General Eric Holder and speak with Robert Weisman, the president of Public Citizen, who has been a critic of the Justice Department's failure to prosecute Wall Street bankers who not only caused the worst financial disaster since the Great Depression, but were made whole by the taxpayer in the greatest transfer of private debt to public debt in history. We will discuss how Holder's close personal relationship with President Obama has kept him on the job longer than he would have wished, and whether the Attorney General will go back through the revolving door to a big law firm that represents Wall Street and lobbies for their interests in Washington. Then, with the midterm election a little over a month away, we will get an assessment of how the legal battles to overturn voter suppression laws in Texas, North Carolina, Ohio, and Wisconsin are proceeding. Myrna Perez, the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss the new voter ID laws pending since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in states with a long and disgraceful history of disenfranchising minorities with poll taxes poor people could not afford and arbitrary requirements targeted at minorities. We'll look into the status of a critical case on appeal in Texas. She has been working on that. If Governor Perry prevails, will result in 650,000 Texans who have previously voted, some for decades, being denied the vote in November. Then finally, we'll speak with Melanie Sloan, the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, about the secret documents CREW obtained from the Republican Governors Association offering access to governors in exchange for campaign donations from some of America's biggest corporations, whose identities have been shielded from the public through a post-Citizens United use of a 501c4 tax exemption supposed to be used for social welfare. We will discuss how CREW got the documents and the corporate Republican pay-to-play money pipeline they expose. And joining us now is Robert Weisman, who's the president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulation of the financial markets. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Weisman.
It's great to be with you.
And the Attorney General announced today that he is resigning, and there's obviously a lot of speculation about who may replace him, but he has been under fire for the longest time, and I guess he's something of a survivor, isn't he? I mean, the Congress has been out to get him, and he's been, you know, under attack for failing to close Guantanamo. He was unable to prosecute the mastermind of 9/11. He was unable or unwilling or whatever, we'll get into that, of holding Wall Street bankers accountable for the near-death experience of the global economy and this painful recovery that's impacted the lives of, downsized the lives of millions of Americans, not to mention millions of people around the world. And he's, of course, Daryl Issa has made a big deal out of this stupid Fast and Furious issue. So he's been under attack for a long time. So before we start criticizing him, give me a sense of how it is that he's been able to survive. And I guess he must have a thick skin.
I think he's got a thick skin. I think he has a close relationship with the president, which at the end of the day, once he's confirmed, is all that really matters. I think his record overall is mixed. And moreover, there's an appropriate tradition of giving, fairly free rein to the Attorney General because they serve at the pleasure of the president. They are the nation's chief prosecutor, and they really need to be independent. So they tend to be able to stick around as long as they want to. And I think, according to the news reports, he's wanted to leave for a while, and Obama really wanted him to stay. So it's not a surprise, and he probably could have stayed for the full Obama term if he'd preferred to.
Well, apparently he's one of the few cabinet members who are routinely invited over for dinner and drinks with the president, along with Education Secretary Arne Duncan. And he also is the only cabinet member who times his summer vacation to hang out with the president at Martha's Vineyard. And I believe their wives are incredibly close too. They seem to have regular Friday night pizza dinners at Eric Holder's house. So this is something of a tradition, isn't it, that presidents have always wanted to have somebody in, who's close to them as the Attorney General. I remember, you know, with Nixon, with Mitchell, et cetera. As long as I can remember, and I remember Bill Clinton tried to get his buddy from Arkansas in, didn't he, that Webb Hubble, that blew up in his face.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's mixed. You know, Janet Reno wasn't close to Clinton. I don't think that.
But
you know,
she wasn't his first
experience
choice.
The experience with her under George Bush was mixed with the different AGs.
Right. Well, let's talk about Eric Holder's record then, and you're critical of his record, Robert Weissman, particularly in terms of a failure to hold Wall Street to account. What's your understanding of why that's the case? And there's been a little bit of activity lately, but it's most people have dismissed it as being too little too late.
You're right. I mean, I think the first thing to say is, like, this is just one piece of his overall record, and I think that record is mixed. But in the area of holding Wall Street accountable, holding corporate criminals accountable, it's not a mixed record. It's a horrible record. And it's a horrible record characterized by inactivity and failure to hold the most powerful people who've inflicted enormous harm on the country as well as the world accountable for what they did. And it's a record of failure to criminally prosecute financial institutions, even when they're found to be money laundering at epic scale for narco-traffickers and countries that the U.S. designates as enemy, because of a fear of undermining the overall economy because these companies had grown too big to fail, or as it's become known, too big to jail.
So one of the things I've noticed about these settlements that have happened with the big banks, with HSBC over money laundering, with Mexican drug cartels, etc., and these recent payouts by the big Wall Street banks over the excesses of 2008, or at least the build-up to 2008, and with Bank America also doing a payout recently, what is so clear about all of these is that these companies pay money, but there's no skin in the game. None of the people that made the decisions that led to the crisis go to jail. So who's responsible for that pattern, do you think?
Yeah, this is high-level decision-making. So this rests with Eric Holder. This is not; these are not decisions being made at low levels by subordinates that he has not engaged in. This is high-level decision-making. This is going to be a crucial and really unfortunate defining piece of Eric Holder's legacy. This is either the decision to let the Wall Street criminals go free. That's Eric Holder's decision.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Weissman, who's the president of Public Citizen and expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulation of the financial markets. So in terms of all of this speculation about successes, is anybody on the lists, Catherine Rumer, former White House counsel, Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, Solicitor General Donald Varelli, former Governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, Loretta Lynch, the U.S. Attorney for Brooklyn, and Kamala Harris, the Attorney General of the State of California. Does any of that portend to you that there be an improvement over the enforcement of the law in terms of the deficiencies that you have listed here in terms of Eric Holder's tenure?
Well, you know, I really don't have any insight into what the president is thinking about a replacement. That's a long list. I don't know the details of any of them. Someone like Senator Whitehouse, I think, has been very aggressive in a lot of key areas and is willing to talk tough to big business. Is he a serious candidate for it? I really don't know.
Well, there's a story in Thursday's New York Times about how Wall Street has come up with a new racket that's almost identical to the subprime racket they had with housing. And this is in terms of automobiles. And in the case of the build-up to 2008 on Wall Street and the subsequent crash, throughout that whole period where the subprime loans, housing loans, liar's loans were going out the door with Countrywide Savings and all of these banks on Wall Street. And the thing that I find so disgusting about it all was that most of the victims were people who were aspiring to get into the middle class, working Americans, quite often poor. They put everything they had into what they thought was their little piece of the American dream, and it turned out to blow up in their face, and they ended up living in their cars. And now we find out from Thursday's New York Times that Wall Street is now coming up with a new subprime scam, and that is selling cars to poor people who can't buy them the conventional way, giving them these liar's loans. But they put a device in the car which disables it if you can't pay your payments, which obviously you end up paying, you know, four or five for the car two or three times over because you put no money down, and all of those ways that they lured people in back in the subprime housing boom. And now the subprime lenders are doing the same with people buying cars. And the story is absolutely heartbreaking. Some woman had to go take a relative to hospital and turned on the car, and it didn't work because she was late on payments and had to, you know, literally make a choice between a life or death choice. So what is it about our culture that preys on the poor?
Well, I think big corporations go where the money is. And if they can figure out ways to rip off poor people and make a lot of money, they're going to do it. If they can rip off better off people, they're going to do that too. And there's no excuse for the behavior of these companies or the executives who innovate these schemes, and the story you're referring to is really both heartbreaking and unusually outrageous. And not only do they turn off their cars, they have monitoring devices so they can just deeply intrusively monitor where people are going in their lives. It's really almost unfathomable. But the solution is not to hope for the companies to do better. It's to impose rules that prohibit this kind of activity and that force them to do better. And then if you have rules in place, then you have to enforce them. And when the companies violate the rules, they have to be punished. And I think what we saw with Eric Holder is the companies, the Wall Street banks, all the way from, you know, the mortgage lenders on the ground, all the way to the traders in exotic derivatives, violated the rules wildly, laughed about it in many cases, and then effectively were able to do so with impunity because there was no criminal prosecution at all from Eric Holder's Department of Justice. So why are they doing it now? Well, why not? They got away with it last time. Why shouldn't they go ahead and try to get away with it again?
And of course, the evidence is pretty stark. The difference, or the contrast, is pretty stark between what happened with the savings and loan ripoffs in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. I think over 1,000 of these savings and loans executives went to jail. And as we mentioned earlier, virtually nobody's gone to jail for the worst disaster that hit the American economy since the Great Depression.
Yeah, and you know, it made a difference for a while. It wears off after a while. So that's right. I think it's more than 1,000, as you say, were criminally prosecuted and went to jail for a really big financial crisis, but really big, like it cost the national economy about $500 billion. This one cost about $14 trillion. So it's more than an order of magnitude bigger. It doesn't involve just piddly little savings and loans spread out throughout the country. These are the biggest financial institutions in the world, intentionally gaming the system in every way they can, crashing the economy, throwing us into the worst recession since the Great Depression, just throwing millions of people out of their homes, enormous hardship, as you say, across the country, and the perpetrators get away scot-free. And that's on Eric Holder's watch.
So just in closing, Robert Weissman, I believe that the big law firm that Eric Holder used to work for, is it across the street from the Justice Department, Covington & Burling?
Yeah, I'm not sure what their address is. It may well be.
Yeah, that's my understanding. So, and we know that Lenny Brewer, the guy that, at the Justice Department who was supposed to go after Wall Street, he ended up going through the revolving door and ending up at a law firm on Wall Street that represents the bankers. Is Eric Holder likely to go back to his old job as a corporate lawyer at the building across the street?
Well, you know, I sure hope not, but you're right to point out that's where he came from. So the revolving door is fast at work. It's not just a matter of appearances. The mindset of people when they're in government is affected by where they've been and where they're going. And I think you look at someone like Lanny Brewer, who was the guy in charge of the criminal justice division that failed to prosecute these money laundering financial institutions, didn't really seriously investigate the Wall Street criminals. He's sympathetic to these people because he works with them. And he knows them so well, and he represented them, and now he's representing them again.
Well, Robert Weisman, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Weisman, who's president of Public Citizen and an expert on economics, healthcare, trade and globalization, intellectual property and regulatory policy, and issues related to financial accountability and corporate responsibility. He's written extensively on corporate accountability, access to medicines, corporate influence over the political process, the World Trade Organization, and regulations of the financial markets. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the legal battles to overturn voter suppression laws ahead of the midterm elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Myrna Perez, who is the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, focusing on a variety of voting rights-related issues, including redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot box. She clerked for the Honorable Anita Brody of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and for the Honorable Julio Fuentes of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Welcome to Background Briefing, Myrna Perez.
Thank you so much for having me.
And as the midterm elections approach, Myrna Perez, we've got very little time left before the November elections. And my understanding is that minority turnout is key to it, key to the Democrats holding the Senate. And there's obviously been efforts on a part of a lot of Republican governors to find ways with voter IDs, et cetera, to suppress the Democratic vote in Texas, North Carolina, and in Wisconsin. You're fighting against these bills in these various states. What's the status of the battle now? Because we don't have a lot of time left before the elections.
Certainly. And I, there are just like a couple of things that I hope your readers or your listeners are able to take away. In this instance, when it comes to our democracy, we want our elections to be free, fair, and accessible. It's not about the party. It's not about who wins. It's about voters being able to cast ballots that will count and to have their voices heard. And in a number of states, there are fever pitch battles over the right to vote. There are laws that have been implemented in the last few years or attempting to be implemented that will make it harder for eligible Americans to vote. One of the matters that I'm involved in is in the state of Texas, which in 2011 passed what is arguably the country's strictest photo identification law, and it went before a judge, three judges in fact, under a particular provision of the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court has rendered inoperable. before the Supreme Court acted, a three-judge court found this law impermissibly made minority voters worse off. Now that that protection is no longer with us, we're challenging it again. So we're before a district court judge in Corpus Christi. We just had closing arguments on Monday. I'm very hopeful that we will prevail, but there are other litigations that are getting a lot of attention and throwing a lot of uncertainty into what voters can experience. There's an ongoing challenge in Wisconsin. There's an ongoing challenge in Arkansas. There's an ongoing challenge in North Carolina. There's an ongoing challenge in Ohio. And that's just some of the most high-profile cases. And so I think at a time where we don't have enough Americans participating, we don't want to place unnecessary and unjustified barriers in front of the ballot box. And my hope is that, you know, all voters go out to vote, all voters express themselves and make a choice for the kind of leadership that they want in their state houses and in Congress. And come next legislative cycle, we will see more bills that expand access to the ballot box and make it easier for eligible Americans to participate.
My understanding, though, is in North Carolina, one of the Republican candidates, I'm not sure what office he's running for, he's running on the basis, and I heard the commercial, he's running on the basis that we need voter IDs because, after all, you need an ID to drive a car, a driver's license, you need a photo ID to get on an airplane. So why shouldn't you have a voter ID to cast the sacred ballot, which is the hallmark of democracy?
I think there's no question that we want an election system that is secure. There's no question that we want integrity in our election system, and there's no dispute that voters should have confidence in their outcomes. But photo ID laws are different. They differ across states. They differ in terms of what is accepted, what kinds of IDs are accepted. They differ in terms of their exemptions. They differ in terms of how easy it is to access the IDs, you know, depending upon the cost or how open the issuing offices are. And so there's no blanket rule about whether a ID requirement for voting is going to be burdensome or not. But what we do know in some states that it is, right? The facts on the ground are such. In Texas, for example, we offered evidence that about 608,000 registered Texans do not have the kind of identification that is needed in order to be able to cast a ballot that will count. The court heard from some of them. We brought in voters who attempted to vote in the 2013 election, which was an off-season election where you didn't have you know, the kind of turnout that is expected in the general. And we were able to find voters who were unable to cast ballots that will count. They tried, but they didn't have the right kind of ID that was required. We heard from some people saying that in order to get the kind of ID that was required, they were going to have to spend money that they didn't have. I mean, one woman very eloquently said that it was going to cost her $42 to get her birth certificate, and she couldn't spend her family's money on that because you couldn't eat a birth certificate. You couldn't pay rent for a birth certificate, and she needed to put her family's money toward food. We heard evidence of other people who were running out of milk for their children and needed to depend upon the charity of others to be able to feed their family, and just how expensive and onerous it would be for them to scrape up the money that would come, that would be required in order for them to get the kind of ID that they needed to vote. And those are examples of burdens that are unjustified. We proved that minorities have fewer access to vehicles in their homes, and that in a number of instances, there's long distances that are required to get to the places that give one ID, and that when one has to rely on things like bus transportation and that sort of stuff, it could lead to a lot of time that would be expended, and that kind of those kinds of burdens fell disproportionately among minority voters. You know, that doesn't mean that identification in another state is going to have the same kinds of burdens, because the ID law is going to be different and the population that is missing the ID is going to be different, and they might have different exemptions. So I don't think the question is as simple as, you know, ID or no ID, but what we should all be asking ourselves as Americans is, when we impose a barrier to the ballot box, what are we getting for it? How much more secure does it make our election system? How much more confidence does it give us? How much better does it improve our administration? And weigh that against how many people don't have this kind of ID, how many people are going to be having to make choices between feeding their family and voting, and what kind of country we want to be. I don't think America wants to be the kind of country where someone has to choose between feeding their family and voting.
But we're also a country with a history of huge impediments to voting, particularly in the South. That's why we had the Voting Rights Act of 1965, because for all throughout the Jim Crow era, there were all kinds of barriers put up in the very same spirit of protecting the vote and all of this stuff that we're hearing today. So, and the people that you're talking about who have to make these Sophie's choices over food on the table for the kids or getting this voter ID that they need to, in order to vote, these are people who have voted for years and years and years without a problem. So does that...
I mean, that's certainly true with our affected people in Texas.
So,
people, but what are, one of the long-time voters... You know, in one instance, there was someone that actually, like a poll worker, actually knew who this person was. There was no question about this person's identity. So, and, you know, that person still wasn't able to cast a ballot that will count.
And how do you think these arguments are going? Is our judiciary still independent enough and civic-minded enough to feel, as you have expressed, that this is an American right? This is not about Democrats and Republicans. This is about the fundamentals of American democracy, yet we live in such a charged political atmosphere with enormous political paralysis and gridlock in Washington. And, you know, it's pretty clear that these efforts since the Supreme Court struck down the Voting Rights Act, or these preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, that these laws suddenly popped up, didn't they? I mean, they didn't. There's almost a direct connection between the Supreme Court decision and almost the next day, suddenly, in legislatures across the country, they're introducing these voting restriction laws.
No, I mean, I think there's no question that the day the Supreme Court issued its decision in Shelby County, which gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act, we immediately saw some state officials, including Governor of Texas, say that their laws that had been on hold because of the Voting Rights Act would proceed. There was a very public statement made by a legislator in North Carolina who effectively said that now that there was no longer Voting Rights Act prohibition, they were going to load up the bill. The first version of the bill was just going to be a photo ID bill, and then by the time it was done, it was an omnibus bill that had cutbacks to early voting, elimination of same-day registration, elimination of pre-registration, you know, different rules regarding counting ballots at polling places, that sort of thing. So there's no question in my mind that Section 5 proved to be a deterrent against behavior that would diminish access to the ballot box. And right now, we are trying to battle that out. We're trying to figure out how it is that we protect voters when we don't have the most effective tool this country had in combating racial discrimination at the ballot box. I'm hopeful. I'm always hopeful. I think the American public wants free, fair, and accessible elections, and that ultimately we'll get there. Ultimately, we'll prevail.
Well, how do you think the resignation of Attorney General Eric Holder is going to affect this battle that you've been engaged in to overturn some of these voting restrictions that have been brought about in states like Texas, North Carolina, Ohio, and Wisconsin since the Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act last June? Eric Holder has made enforcing the Voting Rights Act a key priority in the Justice Department. He successfully challenged Texas voters' ID law that you mentioned earlier, South Carolina's voter ID law, and Florida's cutbacks in early voting under the VRA, and of course has vowed an aggressive response to the Supreme Court's gutting of the VRA last June.
I think it's too soon to tell. I'm hopeful that the Department of Justice will continue with its mission of doing justice and protecting voters, and I, at this point, I have no reason to believe that that mission won't be honored, respected, and continued with the predecessor. With the successor.
Well, where do we stand then in with Governor Scott Walker's situation in Wisconsin? That one seems to be in flux. Which of these states do you think there'll be resolution before the elections? I know you've been working in Texas, and I guess it's any day now that there'll be a ruling, right?
We expect a ruling soon. And in North Carolina, they had a hearing with respect to the preliminary injunction that was denied this week. And there are motions before the Seventh Circuit in Wisconsin. I mean, I think no one has a crystal ball. We're watching them all. You'll have people speculate, but it's going to be a lot of speculation. And when you make a bunch of guesses, someone's going to be right. But I do think that it wouldn't surprise me to hear more activity on any of these cases before the November election.
So is there any place where you think the clock's going to run out, where it's simply people that have voted for years will show up and be denied their vote because they don't have the requisite voter ID? And with the days counting down to the elections, and you mentioned sometimes people have trouble with transportation, et cetera, to go to wherever this office is. I mean, it doesn't sound like in any of these cases that they're making it easy for people to get the ID that's required. It's not like Motor Voter or other efforts that happened here in California, for example, that were an attempt to make it easy to vote as opposed to make it difficult to vote.
I certainly think that that's for, you know, for the vast majority of people, obtaining an ID will not be burdensome. But for the people that it is burdensome, it's going to be very burdensome. It's going to be very difficult. There's very likely to be a reason why someone doesn't have an ID. Your life is easier if you have it. So if you don't, there's a rationale. You don't have a birth certificate. You never had a birth certificate. You have a birth certificate with incorrect information on it. I happen to have lost my wallet yesterday, so I don't have if I lived in a state that required a photo ID and we had to vote tomorrow, I wouldn't have a driver's license to present. I mean, I think people have specific circumstances, and the big question is why are we trying to make eligible Americans have a more difficult time voting, and what are we getting when we do that? And is that a smart policy justification? Is it making our elections more secure? Is it making our administration better? Is it improving the integrity of our elections? And I think we are seeing in a number of instances that it's not. What we instead see is that it's not making our elections run better or be more secure, but there are real people who are going to be locked out of the system. And I think Americans want our elections to be free, fair, and accessible, and they don't want politicians manipulating the rules of the game so that some people can vote and some don't. And my hope is that the voters that do turn out in November, remember that the right to vote is fundamental, and that when they're engaging in that protected and sacred act, that they are making their voice be cast in such a way that our leaders hear the need to make our elections more accessible.
Well, just in closing, after the Patriot Act that was passed after 9/11, one of the provisions I understand was, there was a call for a national ID card so that people knew who were in the country. There wasn't a thorough and isn't a thorough inventory of everybody in the country. That was the theory after 9/11, because these hijackers were able to get IDs, etc. And that was a part of, I believe, either in the Patriot Act or certainly in the debates about it. And I know that progressives and liberals are opposed to the idea of an identity card, which has echoes of show me your papers from the Gestapo days. But if such a thing were to come about, would that put to rest this nonsense over these requirements to prove who you are? If you have a document that proves who you are once and for all, will they stop these shenanigans? Would they stop these shenanigans?
If the ID required was an ID that everybody had, it is unlikely that an ID law would be disenfranchising. If I mean, an ID law is only disenfranchising if some people don't have it. So if everybody has it, it's not disenfranchising.
And is that a possible way to solve this or to get around it?
Certainly some people have explored the idea. Certainly some people are trying to get IDs in the hands of people that don't have them. Certainly some high-level political leaders have suggested that that be one way to deal with it. I think it might be, and that's not my area, and, sure. and I'm hoping that other people will study it. But in the meantime, in the 2014 election, I want to make sure that every eligible American is able to cast a ballot that will count.
Sure. Well, I bring it up because right next door in Mexico, they have such a card. So, but I thank you for joining us, Mona Perez.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Mona Perez, who is the director of the Voting Rights and Election Project at the Brennan Center for Justice, focusing on a variety of voting rights-related issues, including redistricting, list maintenance, and access to the ballot box. She clerked for the Honorable Anita Brody of the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania and for the Honorable Julio Fuentes of the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Crewe, who obtained secret documents from the Republican Governors Association. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Melanie Sloan, who serves as the Executive Director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Previously, she served as an Assistant United States Attorney in the District of Columbia, where from 1998 to 2003, she successfully tried cases before dozens of judges and juries. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melanie Sloan.
Oh, so nice to be with you.
And these documents that you got hold of, which are obviously quite explosive and extremely embarrassing to the Republican Governors Association, seem to get at the heart of this problem we have with dark money. And this is for the first time, I think, there's been real evidence of how much corporate America prefers to use this so-called 501c4 vehicle to hide donations. My understanding is that what has restrained corporate America from partisan politics is that quite often or not, these big corporations have 50% of their customers are Democrats and 50% of their customers are Republicans, and they don't want to offend either, so they stay out of politics. But this vehicle seems to have given them an excuse to get involved in partisan politics. Is that what's going on here?
Yes, that is exactly right. So much of the time, these big companies don't want to offend their customer base because we are such a closely divided nation. And now, through these 501c4 organizations, they can anonymously donate to very political organizations, and their customers need never find out about it.
So in the coverage of these documents that you got hold of in the New York Times, all we understand is that a simple coding mistake laid bare these documents. Can you tell us how you managed to get these documents?
It was simply a Google search for a PDF. So, you know, the RGA has suggested there was some improper hacking involved, and really we don't even have the technical skills to be involved in hacking. All our research staff did was Google RGA PDFs, and these came up. So it was really their mistake because they have all these membership documents that are supposed to be under, I guess, a hidden section of their website, and they're just not.
So, in other words, the tax-exempt part of the Republican Governors Association, the Republican Governors Public Policy Committee, somehow their documents, which relate to this 501c4 dark money vehicle, they just...
were just easily accessible on the web by anybody.
Wow.
And we just happened to find them.
And they're now blaming the messenger.
They are now blaming the messenger, because what else are they going to say? Yes, we really do sell access.
Well, let's talk about that. This is what it really comes down to. Give us a sense of how much access is being sold here and how much the Republican Governors Association are literally sort of, you know, offering themselves up like prostitutes.
Well, we have some other documents that the RGA puts out that says there's a governor's circle for a $1,000 contribution, a governor's board membership for $50,000 annual contribution, the governor's cabinet membership for $100,000, and the RGA statesman membership for $250,000. And each of these different membership tiers offers different benefits. And obviously, at the $250,000 range, you get a lot more benefits than you do at the $1,000 or even the $50,000 range. And mostly you get things like for $250,000, you get a Celebration of America's Leaders Gala, which includes a private dinner with the chiefs of staff for the Republican governors and a private breakfast with the governors. You get to go to a senior staff retreat with members of the RGA, and you get to participate in roundtable policy discussions. So there is just this endless list of things that you get, including a directory of an RGA directory that will guide you to all of the governor's offices and have handy contact information for the chiefs of staff, DC directors, schedulers, and policy advisors, so that you can always get somebody on the phone.
Again, I'm speaking with Melanie Sloan, who is the executive director of CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And she's a nationally recognized expert on congressional ethics and previously served as an assistant United States attorney in the District of Columbia, where from 1998 to 2003, she successfully tried cases before dozens of judges and juries. My understanding, though, is that with the gridlock in Washington, where nothing's getting done and there's an almost complete paralysis, most of the activity now is at the state level in governor's offices and in state legislatures, and that these big plutocratic money machines like the Koch brothers are really starting to focus on state legislatures and governors. So this seems to, if this is true, this seems to make what you've uncovered more significant.
Yes, it is true. You know, I think that probably states have always been important, but there is this increased focus and attention on states where we're seeing so much more legislative activity than we are at the federal level. And I think the real particularly interesting thing that we turned up in our document search is we got this list of different companies and people from these companies who are participating in these different activities. So we found out that, you know, Aetna is participating in all of these things, a donor to the RGPCC, PPC, and we found that Motorola and Pfizer and Pharma, and maybe nobody would be particularly surprised that these organizations were donating to these to the Republicans in this way, but by the same token, now there's proof positive, and a company like Aetna I find particularly interesting because Aetna says they have a really great transparent process. They have argued against the need for disclosure of political donations, saying that they're already an incredibly transparent company. But if you go to their political contribution reports that they file, they don't include this money. This isn't transparent at all. So they are telling you just what they want you to see.
But that's the problem, isn't it, that this vehicle now has become so popular, this 501c4, which is designated by the IRS as social welfare, have become overtly political. I don't understand why, I guess because of this phony IRS scandal that's been ginned up by Republicans like Daryl Issa, that maybe has intimidated the IRS into cracking down on them. I understand that their investigations that got them in trouble, where they use buzzwords like on the left, Occupy, and on the right, Tea Party, that created a big furor, and it probably hasn't intimidated the IRS into doing something. But my understanding was that what the IRS were doing was they're getting flooded with these applications, and they wanted to do some kind of triage. So is that what's happened here, is that this new vehicle that clearly favors the Republicans, it clearly favors corporate America in as much as it gives them anonymity, has been basically politically enabled by the Republicans in the House, who have, you know, again, blamed the messenger. They've gone after the IRS instead of allowing the IRS to do its job, which is to police this category of social welfare. I can't see how anybody can see political campaign money as social welfare.
No, I can't either. And this is something that we've been concerned about for a long time. The IRS has let too much go on under the auspices of social welfare for many years. It's not a brand new problem, but obviously this became a much bigger problem post-Citizens United. And we had been pushing the IRS to enforce its own laws even before this faux IRS scandal. And they weren't doing it, frankly. So they weren't doing a good job even before this. And then after the pretend scandal, they basically backed off any enforcement at all. Now, they have issued proposed regulations, but their proposed regulations were not very good, not very much of an improvement, and then they withdrew those proposed regulations. They're coming out with a new set of proposed regulations. But basically, they have been so intimidated by the constant criticism and hearings that Daryl Issa and his colleagues are holding, that they are not enforcing the law in any way, and I think that's really a shame. But I have to say that I thought this was a shame even before this scandal, and I thought that the IRS ought to have been doing far more, because this has been a growing problem. And what people don't see as much, in addition to this C4 problem, there's another section of the law called 501c6 of the tax code, which governs trade associations and business leagues, and the Chamber of Commerce is a business league. And because there has been more attention going to the use of 501c4s for political activity, I think other organizations are now starting to form their own 501c6 organizations and engaging in political activity that way. And the IRS also has not been governing 501c6s very well. So I think you're going to see people who want to hide the money and have more anonymous money going into our system looking for new loopholes all the time. And when you have an agency that has been basically lax as the IRS has about this issue, you really have a big problem. And in some respects, it's not the IRS's fault. The IRS is a revenue-collecting agency. It was never set up to monitor political activity and decide what political activity was too much. And so we have a state of law that really just hasn't kept up with the state of our campaign finances.
So in terms of the Republican Governance Association going after you, Crew, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, Melanie Sloan, they've accused you of hacking, and you've pointed out that this was just publicly available on their website. They clearly screwed up in terms of not hiding it properly. But their charge that you're no longer a nonpartisan organization, because you're headed up by David Brock, who used to be with a kind of on the Republican, I think it was on the kind of hit team that went after the Clintons, and then had a recognition of how what he was doing, I guess, you know, he had a change of heart, for the want of a better description. And as far as I know, has been involved in trying to clean up politics. So in labeling him as being partisan, what's your understanding, since you work with him? Your organization has basically gone after crooked Democrats and crooked Republicans, haven't you?
We have gone after crooked Democrats and crooked Republicans, and even as recently as last week, we were talking about the ethics problems of a Democratic congressman from Indiana, Pete Viscoski. So Crew hasn't changed. And I think really this is just a case of the RGA trying to change the subject. The RGA's documents speak for themselves. Nobody has to look at what Crew is saying or look at our motives at all. Nope, the RGA is not denying these are their documents, and people should read the documents for themselves and then make their own decision.
So how can people read these documents?
The documents are available on our website at citizensforethics.org.
Citizensforethics.org. And these are documents that one of them, I believe, listed 17 corporate members of the Governors Association secretive 501c4, the Republican Governors Public Policy Committee. And some of these big corporations are like the who's who of corporate America, aren't they?
Yes, it's some of the biggest corporations in America. And the other thing that we have on our website is the RGPPC, the Education Symposium. And so you can see all of the different events that were being held for all these top donors and who from the governor's staffs were attending them. So you could see why people would want to go to them. But you definitely see that it's huge companies, you know, WellPoint, Reynolds, United Health Group, a lot of healthcare, Corrections Corporation of America, ExxonMobil, Koch Industries, Motorola, Pfizer.
So is there a Democratic equivalent on the Democratic Governors Association of this kind of 501c4 dark money slush fund?
There is a Democratic equivalent. There is, I forget its name. It's like the Center for Innovative Leadership or something like that. But and I'm not doubting that they do something similar. But and we looked actually to tell you, we did look for their documents too. But those are not accessible. You couldn't find those on their website.
Right. So
whatever they may be doing, I don't know. But you know, the other point is, Democrats are traditionally, while I'm sure that they undoubtedly have major corporate donors as well. A lot of these donors have tended to give far more money to Republicans. And Aetna is a company I'm most familiar with, and they donate by far the largest amount of their money goes to Republicans and Republican causes. So I think a lot of these different kinds of organizations, obviously the Koch industry is well tied to Republicans, and big pharmaceutical companies have had closer relationships with Republicans over time, and often Corrections Corporation of America, which is the private prisons company, again, very closely tied to Republicans. So a lot of big businesses do donate more money to Republicans because they view them as more closely allied with business interests.
And probably most of the boardroom are Republicans, right?
Probably.
So is there something going on, though, within the Republican Party? My understanding is that traditional Chamber of Commerce-type Republicans, well, we know, there's no secret, there's a kind of a civil war going on in the Republican Party between the traditional pro-business Chamber of Commerce-type Republicans and the more insurgent, vocal, and activist Tea Party wing. And it's reached a point now where most of the Republican contenders for the presidency have to sort of bow to anti-intellectualism. They have to renounce evolution. They have to say that global warming is a hoax, etc. So does corporate America, are they losing access to a party that's becoming more radical and more anti-intellectual and in many cases downright crazy?
Yeah, well, there's no question that they are often preaching things that are completely crazy, particularly when you talk about something like climate change and evolution. And climate change, I always find the most ironic because every insurance company just takes climate change as a given in their actuarial tables because they just have to if they're going to be insuring people in floodplains. They have to take account of climate change changing, you know, the number of times a space will flood. But yet at the same time, many of the people in those kinds of in those insurance companies are still funding Republican members of Congress who preach that there is no problem with climate change and it's all a hoax. So there is certainly that problem, and one can hope that one day cooler heads will prevail and people will recognize that these are not realistic ways to govern. But so far, you know, we're not seeing that. Obviously, we are still having fights over things like the Export-Import Bank, and others are threatening to hold the government hostage and shut it down again in a future date. So I think that the, you know, and we saw the loss of Eric Cantor, the House Majority Leader, earlier this year. A big surprising loss to a Tea Party Republican. So it's the battle still rages on, and I think most Americans really need to pay attention to what's going on in Washington and think about whether these are the kind of people they want to be governing them. And they also need to be aware of the incredible level of money that's flowing into our political system and how much influence it really does buy. So when politicians get on the morning talk shows and say, oh, no, I didn't say that for the money. The money has no impact on me. You know, just people should think about, would $250,000 impact their thinking? I bet it would. People are a little more open and friendly to people who give them $250,000.
Well, just in closing then, Melanie Sloan, my question is, though, does this money that comes from corporate America that's unaccounted, unattributed because of this ability to use the IRS 501c4 social welfare vehicle to hide these donations that obviously get corporate America off the hook with their customers who don't know who they're giving money to? But presumably, as you just said, you know, money comes with strings attached. There's always a quid pro quo. Given that the business side of the Republican Party is being sort of buffaloed by the Tea Party side, does this money then, do you think, change that dynamic? Is this an internal way for the Republicans to fight back, apart from simply buying political access? Presumably, when you buy a politician, you buy your kind of politician.
Well, I think they do, but when they're giving to the Governors Association, and the governors, you know, they'll tend to support, they don't generally play in primaries, so whoever the nominee is will be the person who is supported. So you still haven't seen a lot of willingness on the part of Republicans to play favorites in primaries and try and beat out some of the Tea Party folks, although I think you've seen a little more of that in 2014 than you did, say, in 2012, because there are some, in many cases, less extreme candidates. But I think it's just so important for people to be aware of the amount of money flowing into our system and recognize that when, sadly, like our Supreme Court says, the majority says that money, there's no evidence that money is corrupting. You know, nobody believes that. Obviously, money is corrupting. If we don't push harder to get a different system, our system is going to be just owned and operated by corporate America, and the regular people are really going to lose out.
And our politicians have been turned into telemarketers. Spending all their time.
Rising money. And I don't even think they're happy doing it.
No. I've talked to a few. They find it onerous. Again, the website to get this information. This is secret documents about how corporate America is funding Republican governors that was accidentally put on their website and accessed by crew. Where do the public read these documents?
You can find the documents on our website at citizensforethics.org.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Melanie Sloan.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Melanie Sloan, who is the Executive Director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW. She's a nationally recognized expert on congressional ethics and previously served as an assistant United States attorney in the District of Columbia, where from 1998 to 2003, she successfully tried cases before dozens of judges and juries. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.